This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
We are finishing the October edition of The Trumpet this week. We have a cover story by Gerald Fleury about an important trend in Europe, the return to public prominence of the Holy Roman Empire. He talks about an exhibit in Austria that celebrates Charlemagne, how the government of Sebastian Kurz is openly talking about religion. He's seeking counsel from Catholic priests. It's quite a remarkable story. You can watch for that. It'll be up on thetrumpet.com soon. Well, here in our week in review, we have quite a few blockbuster stories from a prophetic perspective. We're going to start in Germany, where we're seeing a significant prophetic trend playing out, the separation between Germany and America. Germany's foreign minister wrote a landmark article laying out a radical shift in German foreign policy. And for this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Germany's foreign minister on Tuesday, he published an article called Making Plans for a New World Order. And it was, well, Handelsblatt, where he published the paper, they called it just the overturning 70 years of German foreign policy. Basically, what he said is that Europe needs to form a counterweight, and that when America crosses the line, Europe acts against them or in opposition to America. He talked about how America and Europe had been drifting apart for years. He said he doesn't think that will end after Donald Trump's presidency. He sees this as a permanent shift. And so he's calling for just a fundamental change in Germany's alliance or Europe's relationship with America. The second key thing that he then puts in that article is that he talks about, okay, well, if we're going to act against America, Germany cannot act against America or as a counterweight to America by itself. Therefore, we need to form a much stronger European Union. He said the outstanding aim of our foreign policy is to build a sovereign, strong Europe. Only by joining forces with France and other European nations can a balance with the US be achieved. The European Union must be a cornerstone of the international order. So a shift away from America and then a shift from Germany towards trying to create a stronger Europe so they're able to act against America.
So quite amazing to hear it articulated in such a direct way from Germany's foreign minister. But in a sense, what he's talking about, we've been seeing events move in this direction for quite some time. And really, even in recent weeks, we've seen Germany taking a really hard stance against America and against the Trump administration quite directly in a number of ways.
Absolutely. And to me, that's what makes this story significant. You know, we've been politicians have been talking about this for some time. It was a year ago when Angela Merkel said, well, we need to have a break, or you know, we can't trust our allies like we used to. We've got to go it alone. We've got to go by ourselves. So if this article were just talk, then I think it wouldn't be the top article in our show. Maybe it would be the second story. We'd kind of talk about it for a bit. But there are very concrete actions that go along with this. It's not just the German foreign minister saying, yet again, we need to break with America. And like you said, just in the last week or so, even, we've seen concrete examples of this. Brent was talking about Turkey last week and the way that Europe has lined up behind Turkey. And you've got this radical new situation there where America is putting sanctions on Turkey, trying to harm its economy, and Germany is talking about the possibility of bailing Turkey out. And at the very least, are looking for ways, okay, well, what can we do to loan money, to encourage businesses to keep doing business with Turkey? America's trying to hurt Turkey's economy to punish them. Germany's trying to help them. Just clearly lined up on opposite sides. You have the same thing in Iran, where America is stepping up the pressure, pulling out of the Iran deal, trying to make life harder for Iran to trade with the rest of the world. Europe is scrambling for ways to try and keep that trade going and make it easier for Iran to trade with the rest of the world. Now, that is very hard for Europe. America dominates the financial system. And this was another key element of the German foreign minister's article, where he talked about Europe needed to kind of build a much more independent financial system so they could act in their trade and in their financial dealings outside of the United States. But you know, they were trying to work against the United States in Iran. Then there's the Angela Merkel Vladimir Putin meeting that we saw this weekend. Yeah, that's something we promised we'd talk about more this week. That meeting went ahead, and again, this is something where America is or Europe is quite clearly working against America. You've got the Nord Stream 2 pipeline deal, that we've spoken the most about. That's on the cover of our Trumpet print issue, where Donald Trump really took Europe to task. Or really took Germany to task, saying, well, you're undermining NATO with these pipelines. What are you doing? Well, at that meeting, they reiterated their commitment to these pipelines. They're pushing forwards on that. But then even they started talking about, like you were talking about with Joshua on Wednesday's show. You know, they're talking about getting involved in the Middle East, getting in Germany and Russia, kind of talking together about Syria. And two huge, important, prophetically significant events there, but also just the fact that they're talking about Syria without the United States.
And at the same time that the United States is trying to increase economic pressure against Russia, again, you have, as with Turkey and Iran, you have Europe undermining that effort.
Yes, though Europe did... That's still, I think, a bit more of a complicated thing, because Europe did just increase sanctions on Russia over the last few months, in response to the poisoning of those people in the UK. So, I mean, Germany's still talking, Europe is, and Germany are acting a little bit differently on Russia. But I think if you look at Syria, German foreign policy made a great point on those discussions that are going on in Syria, where they wrote that if this new group of four nations talking about Syria that doesn't include the United States, if they succeed in their work, it would be a profound change in the history of the Near and Middle East. For the first time since 1945, the United States would not be leading the way in a long-term, highly consequential reform of the region. So Europe is very clearly now acting on its own, not just talking about acting on its own.
In these theaters that we're talking about here, you would expect, I guess, just thinking of the Western world operating in more lockstep against, say, a rising authoritarian government in Turkey, an aspiring nuclear power in Iran, an aggressive Russia that really is threatening many of Europe's interests in other areas. And the fact that Europe is taking such a stance against the United States as it tries to bring these situations to heel is quite extraordinary. The language that the German foreign minister used in this article, where he was saying that Europe actually has to act as a counterweight to the United States, that really is a quite an amazing development. But to watch it unfolding in these specific situations, you can see that they really are putting their muscle where their mouth is.
Yes, like you said, it really undermines just the whole liberal worldview. Like, if you believe democracies will act together to increase the power of democracies, well, then yes, Europe's behavior is completely inexplicable. And I think that's the way that so many at the top of America's foreign policy has viewed things. We're all democracies, and we'll all act in support of democracies. If you look at it in terms of interest, and what is in each of these nations' interest, well, then it's no surprise at all that America and Germany on so many of these issues do have very different interests. America is quite far from Turkey. Bringing Turkey down a peg or two would suit them fine. Europe is right next door to Turkey. If Turkey has some kind of economic collapse, they're facing the refugee crisis on steroids. So, of course, they're terrified of the idea of Turkey collapsing. The relationship with Russia, America is near, or the saying in Europe goes, America is far, Russia is near. it's a very different situation for, or Germany's got very different incentives in their dealings with Russia than America has. So America's just trusted Europe. They've trusted them to be part of this liberal world order. But at the end of the day, nations follow interests, and Europe's interests lie in opposing the United States, and they'll just follow those interests.
So looked at from a prophetic standpoint, we've talked a lot over the years about the rift in the transatlantic alliance. From a prophetic standpoint, maybe you could just give us the overview of why we're looking at that and some resources that people could look at if they wanted more information.
Well, it's very easy to point to resources at the moment. We've had just about a big article on this subject in the last two print editions of the Trumpet magazine, because this is a very specific Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about a nation being betrayed by their lovers, by their closest allies, by the ones they give gifts to, the ones they trust to protect them. And the United States has even given Europe nuclear weapons. It's given them American nuclear bombs to fly on European planes, to be based on European bases. Has there ever been a bigger, more significant gift in the history of the world? And then you just look at the protection America's given Europe. Europe's economy, we'll be talking about Germany's economy in the next half, but their whole economy has really flourished because of America's protection. So, America has given all of these gifts, and the Bible prophesies that there will be this backstab. It says, and God warns in Jeremiah, all your lovers have forgotten you, they seek you not. It warns about these lovers turning against the United States, turning against Britain. So very specific prophecies that we're seeing unfolding right now. And you can read about that. We had in our August Trumpet print edition, I had an article, Europe and America, they've lost that loving feeling. And then the cover article of the latest, the September Trumpet print edition, that article that we've talked so much over the last few weeks from Mr. Gerald Flurry, Germany and Russia's secret war against America, exposing how America is, or Germany is already working to undermine America right now. And those two articles will really go through and lay out the prophecies that we're watching here as this unfolds.
All right. Excellent. Excellent articles to go look at. We appreciate that, Richard. We're talking here about how Europe is undermining America's interests. And now we'll look at a couple of stories about how China is doing the same thing. First, America has imposed these fresh sanctions against Iran, trying to force it to negotiate a new nuclear deal. China doesn't appear at all interested in the success of those sanctions, just like Europe. For this, we'll go to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's interesting because you have the national will of the governments of these other countries, not the United States, that would like to stay in the nuclear deal, or at least continue to do business with Iran. And then you have the businesses themselves that operate within those countries, recognizing the fact that it's going to be dangerous for them economically to work with Iran, because the United States has said secondary sanctions would be imposed on them. So if you do business with Iran in the sectors that we are sanctioning them, then we are going to sanction you, individual companies. And so European companies, Indian companies, companies all over the world are pulling out of Iran right now. And so you have the governments that want to continue trading having to figure out other ways to continue trading with Iran. Europe today, just as we're talking, they just announced that they're going to pay Iran $50 million over the next couple of months. The EU is to help their development of the private sector, just as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's in Europe right now, and that just, he's calling this just poison to the Iranian people because they're paying into the coffers of Iran. This is the EU. Frederica Mogherini came out and gave this statement just today that we're going to give Iran $50 million, even though our companies are going to pull out. What we're interested in right now is not that, but I thought I'd mention that, is what China is doing to try and stay at least being able to do business with Iran. Iran derives 70% of its export money, or the money for it gets from exports, its revenues, from oil and oil products. And the heavy sanctions coming down on Iran take place in early November. And the United States has told everyone that buys Iranian oil, you get out or else you're going to face secondary sanctions. And so everyone is getting out, it seems. apart from China. China is figuring out a way that it is going to be able to continue doing business with Iran, even in a post-sanction world. And we've seen this over the past couple of months. They have a special deal with Iran where if decided upon by the two countries, the exports to China of Iranian oil will take place on Iranian ships, and that Iran will organize not just the transit but also pay for the insurance of the oil as it goes in these super tankers. That's one of the expensive things, and it's not the fact that other countries can't buy the oil or they're scared of buying the oil. It's because insurance companies in Europe, in the United States, don't want to insure the tankers that go to all the other countries around the world. And so China is figuring out a way with Iran to be like, hey, we're going to sidestep all those other insurance carriers. And Iran has said, we'll insure our own tankers. We'll put our oil on our own tankers. All 17 of the tankers going to China this month, or in July, they were owned by Iran. And this has been a direct change of policy from the months previous.
And you really would have to view this as directly aimed at undermining what America is trying to do.
Right. The America's whole policy on Iran is predicated on these sanctions squeezing the government in Tehran. If you have the Chinese that are saying that, well, 70% of their budget, their exports, we're still going to be able to buy that up, the United States. You're basically neutering the policy, Mr. Trump's policy in Iran. There is no way around this. So now what do we do? Now, is the United States going to find some type of way to give secondary sanctions on China? Will the United States sanction China for buying up Iranian oil? That is the big question. It's interesting because China can figure out a bunch of other ways to get its oil, and yet it is deciding to do it this way. Sure, they might get a better deal out of Iran just because Iran doesn't have any other buyers right now, but this is, again, a direct anti-American move that Mr. Trump is going to have to try and find some way, other way, to change Iran's behavior. Because if China buys up the oil, they'll continue being able to fund terror.
Well, it definitely plays into several prophetic trends that we're watching. We see we'll definitely have to keep our eyes on how this unfolds in the time ahead. The idea that these other nations are essentially, as you said, neutering the United States policy aimed at bringing Iran under its control and abandoning its nuclear ambitions. It is quite extraordinary how these other nations are siding with Iran under the circumstances. We're just going to go ahead and transition into another related story. We do appreciate that, Brent. On Wednesday's program, Richard Palmer gave a report about China's move to rule the waves, and he talked about how it's increasing its influence in several areas around the world, including Central America, just below America's southern border. And its latest move is a troubling deal with El Salvador. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the timing of this really seems like it was designed almost to intentionally humiliate Taiwanese president Tsai Ing-wen. On Sunday, she returned to Taiwan after a trip to the U.S. and to Paraguay and Belize. And in the U.S., she had avoided, you know, Washington, D.C., and just made an unofficial visit to California. But her visits to Paraguay and Belize were official because those are a couple of the last few countries that maintain diplomatic ties with Taiwan. So then she got back home, and before she could even shake off her jet lag, this announcement comes from El Salvador that they had decided to break off all diplomatic ties with Taiwan and that they were instead working with China and that they would be establishing ties with China. And there's evidence that El Salvador had been asking Taiwan for quite an exorbitant amount of money to build a large new seaport there on their Pacific coast. Taiwan said, you know, this project is economically unfeasible. But China heard about it and said, sure, you know, take our cash, build your port, even if it doesn't look like it's going to be a big moneymaker. But you have to cut ties with Taiwan, and you have to start to view Taiwan the way we do, which is as a kind of a renegade province of China that is destined to soon be officially ruled by the Communist Party in Beijing once again. So I don't think the El Salvadorians have bought into the profound wisdom of Xi Jinping thought all of a sudden, or if they think that the solution to all the world's problems suddenly is capitalism with Chinese characteristics. It was just money. It was about China being willing to cut them a massive check. And there are worries that this port could become, it's just a couple of countries south of the United States, and it could be used for Chinese military purposes. So that's something that makes this story even more concerning.
Right. What is China's interest in cutting that check to El Salvador? Why are they going after El Salvador with, this kind of largesse? We see this type of activity happening in a lot of places around the world, as Richard brought out in that report on Wednesday. The fact that it's happening so close to the United States is definitely raising eyebrows.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, China with these sorts of projects is not concerned about the bottom line economically. They're willing to take a loss in order to buy influence and to buy a potential future location where they can position military assets and things like that. Now, they do already have, since 1999, they've had profound influence a couple of miles away in Panama, both on the Pacific and Atlantic coast there. So strategically, I'm not sure what the value of having like a second base very, very close by in El Salvador would be. But, it's still going to be the sort of thing where in a total war situation, having more of these types of assets established would be valuable.
And meanwhile, Taiwan becomes further isolated, and China seems to be pressing its advantage over Taiwan and getting more and more countries on side against Taiwanese independence.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very important part of this. El Salvador itself is an impoverished nation, 6.5 million people. It's not by any standard a game-changing ally for Taiwan on the other side of the world to have. But El Salvador is the fifth country in just 2 years to switch from allegiance to Taiwan and formal recognition of Taiwan to China. So back in 2016, shortly after Tsai Ing-wen became Taiwan's president, we saw Sao Tome and Principe break off relations with Taiwan in favor of those with China. The next year, Panama followed suit. And then in May of this year, both the Dominican Republic and Burkina Faso also said that they were switching sides. So the list of Taiwan's diplomatic allies at this point is down to just 17. And these are mostly small, less developed countries. No offense to Tuvalu, and it's 11,000 people. But Beijing views Taiwan as a rogue province of one China. And it views it as unqualified for nation-to-nation relations. And of course, they're willing to use force if necessary to bring the island back under their control. And each time a nation breaks ties with Taiwan, as these five have done in just 2 years, they are signaling that they agree with Beijing, that Taiwan is not independent, it shouldn't be free, but rightfully part of China.
And the United States doesn't put up any resistance over this type of thing. It's certainly not, doesn't seem to be at all willing to go to bat for Taiwan.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, the United States ourselves in 1979 made that switch. We decided we no longer recognize Taiwan. From now on, we don't have official relations with them. Of course, we have very significant unofficial relations with them, which are the only reason why Taiwan has been able to remain free for the past 70 years.
Right. We were talking just recently about how the Chinese government pressured U.S. airline companies to kind of withdraw support from Taiwan as well. Yeah, Richard, you had a comment.
Just wanted to point out quickly that America has released a strongly worded statement expressing, and I quote, grave concern over what's happened in El Salvador because of its interference in a Western Hemisphere country. So there you go. There's the United States' response.
So I'm sure the Chinese will be hightailing it out of there sometime really soon in response to that.
Right. before another strongly worded response.
Yeah, if we're not careful, the U.S. the U.S. president might wear a power tie, red in color, something like that. That's how you know he means business.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. If you want more information about that, Jeremiah has an article, China and El Salvador Established Ties and Latest Blow to Taiwan. He draws attention to Gerald Fleury's article, Taiwan Betrayal, that's from some years ago, and puts what has happened regarding Taiwan in its prophetic context. And you can also look for that article coming up from Richard Palmer in the next print edition of The Trumpet. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. A massive storm in the Pacific, Hurricane Lane, is threatening Hawaii. To learn the latest about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Hawaii is currently being drenched with life-threatening amounts of rain. I believe last I checked just before the show, they'd already received over 31 inches of rain, almost 3 feet on the big island, which was causing flooding and landslides. Hurricane Lane is currently a Category 3 storm that's barreling towards the Hawaiian Islands. Hurricanes are actually fairly rare in Hawaii because the waters around the island are 80 degrees and below. This will be the first hurricane to make landfall in Hawaii, if it does actually hit Hawaii, in 26 years, and only the third we know about on record. The last one, Hurricane Iniki, which hit in 1992, led to the deaths of 6 people, injured more than 100, and caused almost $2 billion in damage. Hurricane Lane looks like it might not be quite that devastating, but people are definitely still preparing. State and federal officials are bracing for the storm, with Hawaii opening emergency shelters, closing down public schools for the rest of the week, and placing non-essential government workers on leave. President Donald Trump declared a state of emergency on Wednesday. The U.S. Navy is currently moving its ships and submarines out of Hawaii and preparing them to help with responding efforts for the storm if it gets that bad. Over the past several decades, hurricanes around the world, the frequency of hurricanes around the world has increased around 38%, even though almost all climate change models predict that warming ocean should make hurricanes less frequent. And so, obviously, the logical question is, why is this happening? And as longtime listeners of this show will know, there's a very pivotal prophecy that Jesus Christ himself spoke in Matthew 24, where he predicted that weather disasters, famines, earthquakes, pestilence, and things of that sort would increase as a sign of his imminent return. Natural disasters aren't really natural. God promises in Leviticus 26 that when a nation obeys his laws, they'll get rain in due season, not rain that causes mudslides and billions of dollars worth of damage. And so when things like this happen, as they have happened throughout history and are happening with increasing frequency today, it is a sign that something is wrong in a nation, that God's not keeping that promise to give you that rain in the due season, because we're not keeping our end of the bargain in upholding his laws. Things like this will become more and more frequent as Christ returns, because as other prophecies show, the morality of mankind gets worse and worse as you get in the lead up to Christ's return.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. If you go onto the hub of the Trumpet Hour on thetrumpet.com, we'll put a link to a booklet that we have written on this subject, Why Natural Disasters, that gives a much more complete scriptural explanation of why these types of things occur. We do appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Donald Trump indicating that the U.S. embassy move to Jerusalem could come at a price. Russia's largest military exercises since the Cold War, Germany's booming export industry, and President Trump wading into the debate over land seizures in South Africa. We'll be right back.
Your You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to move America's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was a bold one. Many applauded him for being so unabashedly supportive of Israel, but some observers, including us at The Trumpet, warned that it could come at a price from the Trump administration. Looks like that was probably a correct analysis. For this, we'll turn back to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Mr. Trump was at a campaign rally in West Virginia this week, and he wanted to talk about his accomplishments, speaking to his base. His base is heavily pro-Israel, and so he was talking about how he did the move the embassy. But then he said something extra, tacked it onto the end there, that I don't think was definitely necessarily scripted, and it would have come as a surprise to his audience, I'm sure.
I also recognized the capital of Israel and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem. What happened? Because every president, many presidents, they said, we're going to do it. We're going to move our embassy to Jerusalem. It's going to be the capital of Israel. And we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And then they don't do it. And if there's ever going to be peace, remember I said it, with the Palestinians, it was a good thing to have done because we took it off the table. Because every time there were peace talks, they never got past Jerusalem becoming the capital. So I said, let's take it off the table. And you know what? In the negotiation, Israel will have to pay a higher price because they want a very big thing. They'll get something very good because it's their term next. Let's see what happens. It's very interesting. I've always heard that's the toughest deal of all deals. That's called peace between Israel and the Palestinians. They say that's the toughest of all deals. Let's see what happens.
You know, when the move was made, I remember talking about this and you saying basically something to this effect, that at some point the penny would drop. Donald Trump was going to make, he was going to require more concessions of Israel because they made this move.
Right. At the end of the day, he is a deal maker. He's the chief negotiator. He called negotiator in chief, he calls himself. And this is the deal of the century. That's what he labeled it as, Israeli-Palestinian peace. And so it didn't take a genius to figure out that if he gives something to Israel, he is going to require something of Israel, and that seems like it is coming up soon. And I think that might have surprised a lot of people. Definitely, it's going to be interesting because his base is so pro-Israel in the United States, especially the evangelicals, and so to come up with a policy that is pro-Palestinian, or at least the next gift, whatever that will be. And we don't know what that will be. But once he comes out with that, how is everybody going to respond? How will the relationship with Israel? How will Israel respond to it? Is it a concession that Israel will accept going forward? Or will Israel say, thanks very much for moving the embassy, but we can't accept what you're asking? And then that's going to be basically an affront to Mr. Trump, and Israel will be putting the brakes on this peace process, this deal of the century, not the Palestinians. So we don't know exactly what he means by this gift, but he is speaking at the General Assembly of the UN in late September, and there was a source inside the White House that leaked out today that he will be giving his framework for peace during that speech. So it looks like this next, this thing that he wants to give to the Palestinians, Israelis will be upset about. We might take about a month before we know what it is.
So looking at this from biblical prophecy, we did not expect, and we don't expect, the United States support for Israel, which seems to have been quite strong to this point in the Trump presidency, to last, or at least to be as strong as what we have seen, and we expect Israel to become isolated. These statements from Donald Trump certainly seem to reinforce that view.
For sure. If we look at prophecies that are to take place in our time, especially one in Zechariah chapter 11, it talks about this brotherhood between Israel and Judah breaking up, and at this point, when Zechariah is giving this prophecy, this didn't just happen anciently, or it didn't happen anciently, because Israel was already in captivity when Zechariah was giving his message, and so was Judah for that matter. And so this is obviously an end time fulfillment, and we've proven that the United States is this lead country of modern Israel, biblical Israel, and that Judah refers to the Jews. That one's obvious, and even that was confirmed earlier this year by the Jews themselves, calling themselves the Jewish state. They are Judah, biblical Judah. And so you have this prophecy that says that this brotherhood between Israel or the United States, and people can read the United States and Britain in prophecy and to get the backing on that, this brotherhood between the United States and Britain and Israel will break at some point. And that hasn't happened yet. And so it's something we're looking forward to, or looking to the future to happen. There's also another prophecy in Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 that talks about the peace process, this wound that Israel, modern state of Israel, has. And in this wound, they need to find somebody to help them out. And they're not going to the United States in this prophecy. They actually go to as biblical Assyria. Why not the United States if they're your best ally or they're your best friend? Well, it seems like the break has already taken place by the time we have Israel being backed into a corner so much regarding the peace process, and so they're going to look elsewhere. So those two prophecies show that there will be a break between the United States and Judah. And you can even look to history as well. The northern tribes of Israel, led by Ephraim and Manasseh, they were often at war even with the southern kingdom of Judah. And so for the last 100 years or 70 years, we have really seen an anomaly in some ways of history where we have the United States and Britain being so pro-Israel, and without them, the state of Israel probably wouldn't have got off the ground. And yet, just as ancient times, there will be a break that occurs. And will this will this move by Mr. Trump, this gift for the Palestinians, lead to that break? That's something that we'll be watching for.
For more information about those two prophecies, where would you send listeners?
I would actually get them to read an article. It's a reprint by Mr. Stephen Fleury entitled Band of Brothers. Band of Brothers. It goes through the history of this stunning relationship that Israel's had with the United States and Britain, and then talks about the prophecies that show it will come to its end.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Russia is about to hold its largest war game since the height of the Cold War, and it's invited another nation to participate, one that shouldn't surprise you at all if you know Bible prophecy. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, these massive war drills will be taking place in September, and with 100,000 or more troops and just a vast amount of Russian terrain being covered, they'll be the largest of any Russian military drill since all the way back in 1981 with the Zapad games that were held that year. So that was during one of the iciest chapters of the Cold War back in 1981. And now Russia's holding war games around that same size once again. These games are called Vostok 2018, which just means east. Zapad is west. And Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said that they'll be, quote, unprecedented in scale, both in terms of area of operations and number of military command structure, troops, and forces involved. So I think he's saying in the modern era, like the post-Soviet Union era, they're unprecedented. But it does look like they'll be slightly smaller than those 1981 Soviet games. But it is just a massive set of drills and exercises. The sheer scale of it reveals modern Russia's expansionist ambitions, and that makes it really significant. But something that makes it even more significant, as you mentioned there, is that Russia has invited another country, China, to take part in these games. China has accepted the invitation. They'll be sending about 3,000 soldiers and hundreds of military vehicles, dozens of aircraft to take part. So it's just the latest in a long list of signs showing just how much Russia and China are relying on each other and how military cooperation is becoming more central to that mutual reliance.
That's something that we've been talking about based on the prophecies of the Bible. Clear back to Herbert W. Armstrong for decades talked about that.
Yeah, that's right. As early as 1934, the Plain Truth magazine talked about Russia and China. Let me see. I've got a quote here. The 1934 issue says, Russia would rise up on the world scene with her allies, possibly China or Japan. And of course, that was during a time when there was very little love between Russia and China. And even as that animosity between the two intensified in the 50s and 60s and 70s, Mr. Armstrong maintained that same forecast. He said, despite the hostility that we presently see, these two will, you know, bury the hatchet there and become close allies. And Trumpet editor-in-chief has continued to proclaim that same message. And he has said that Vladimir Putin will be or is the prince of Russia that's mentioned in Ezekiel 38 in the Bible there. And that, you know, he'll end up steering an Asian military bloc to play a major role in World War III. And then Revelation 9:16 gives an important detail about that military bloc. It says it'll have 200 million men in the army. And of course, Russia alone couldn't do that. Their entire population is only 144 million, so that would be impossible for them. But once you begin to get China on side and India and Japan and some of these other nations, it's easy to see how an army of that staggering size could come together.
Where would you send people for more information?
Mr. Fleury's written a very powerful booklet about, you know, it really just goes into detail with all of these various prophecies. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes.
Okay, we appreciate that very much. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our weekend review program on 101.3 KPCG. Back to Germany now. Data published this week showing just what an exporting powerhouse Germany is. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Statistics released on Monday show that Germany is on course to be, well, to have the world's largest trade surplus by far. They're forecast to have a trade surplus of about $300 billion, which that means they would sell in exports $300 billion more than what they take in imports. The local reports that that makes them miles ahead of Japan, the Netherlands, and China. The most exported orientation, or the most export orientated economy in the world. Meanwhile, the country with the largest trade deficit, so this is the country that buys much, much, much more than it sells to other countries, is the United States. So quite the contrast there. And fueling this huge export surplus for Germany is its manufacturing industry. The vast majority of that surplus is German manufacturing. You know, German Mercedes, BMWs, chemicals from its big chemical giants, and just German precision machinery, Siemens, all of these almost household names selling their quality goods all around the world.
Well, that certainly shows just how strong Germany is as a manufacturing power. I suppose people could look at that in some ways as an advantage and a disadvantage to Germany.
That's right. I mean, on the one hand, it means that Germany's prosperity depends on other countries buying their stuff. So if you have any kind of economic downturn, if the United States buys a huge amount of German goods, then, and if you have a downturn in the United States, that means Germany's in trouble. Their economy can shrink very quickly when other countries start cutting back on their imports. It means they can be threatened by people like Donald Trump, who threaten car tariffs on Germany. That could have a huge impact on their economy. So on the one hand, you've got that vulnerability. On the other hand, just the fact that you've got such a broad-based manufacturing system, you've got an economy that can just churn out a lot of stuff, that fundamentally is a strength as well. And sure, you may struggle to find other people to buy those goods when they're not, if they have economic problems, but you've just got that fundamental strength there too. And so much of this economy just defines Germany's foreign policy. Their policy towards the euro to a huge extent revolves around keeping these other European countries locked into the German economy, buying German goods, and helping to keep the euro weak so they can keep selling German goods. On the other hand, yes, you've got the United States, where it's kind of like, well, yeah, they're not dependent on other countries as much for their economic strength or for their prosperity. So they can they don't have that weakness. But at the same time, what does the United States
make? We don't make anything. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And so, okay, Germany may have this weakness, but then at the same time, well, when the chips are down, Germany still has a manufacturing industry, and America has still lost a lot of that.
That fundamental dynamic that you just mentioned, just looked at from a prophetic standpoint, and where the trajectory that Germany is taking relative to the trajectory that the United States is taking, is quite amazing to consider. The fact that Germany is simultaneously in this position where its economy is vulnerable, and the kinds of shocks that we would expect Germany to undergo that would propel it to take the kind of moves that we know that prophecy says it will, that's in place. And the fact that it does have that self-sufficiency, and it is able to turn itself around into, you know, a formidable power in a short amount of time on its, you know, basically pulling itself up by its own bootstraps, is quite amazing. If you were going to be in one position or the other, Germany or America, with respect to exports, you would definitely want to be on the German side in terms of how this is going to project going forward.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at the history, it just gets really interesting, because world power generally follows that just manufacturing power, manufacturing strength. And you look at the British Empire, it was a rising power when it was this manufacturing powerhouse.
Right.
It began to decline in power when it started to be outproduced by nations like Germany and also the United States. And then you had America, just especially like World War II, with I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but America's productive capacity during that war was just astonishing.
Yep.
I think it was something like just in a matter of days, they were building the same number of airplanes that they lost in the Pearl Harbor attack. And it was just this huge economic power that enabled the Allies to win that war. It was a key factor, was just that American economic powerhouse. And you look at who are the manufacturing powerhouses today, and to a large extent, it's Germany and it's China.
Right.
And you've also got other nations like Japan. And it shows this shift in world power that we come up against so much on this show, away from America and towards these other powers.
Really interesting, Richard. For more information, where would you send people?
Well, I think this is a symptom of the rise of Germany. We're seeing this in so many different regions. It's undisputed Germany leads Europe. We're seeing them rise to economic power and leadership. In the first half, we're seeing them rise to foreign policy leadership. So it's a small symptom of that rising power, but that rising German power is something that we need to understand today's world. And so our book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, would be a great place to go to understand what the Bible says about this rise of Germany. Because we've been forecasting that for years. You know, Herbert W. Armstrong was in 1945, while Germany was rubble, and this kind of economic miracle, Wirtschaftswunder, as they call it in Germany, was just unthinkable. And he was saying, watch Germany, they're going to rise up from the ashes. They're going to become this major power. And we see that happening now. So that book, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, will help you see why he was making those predictions and then show you what's coming next.
Hmm. Fantastic. We appreciate that, Richard. And I'd like to hear more about that. I think it is interesting to just consider the prophetic implications of those statistics. Well, the last 2 days on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Stephen Fleury has been talking about the extraordinary development in South Africa, the government deciding to proceed with land seizures from white farm owners. But that move doesn't seem to have Western commentators concerned nearly as much as the fact that America's president, Donald Trump, is criticizing the move. We'll get a report on this from Richard Palmer. Sorry, we'll get a report on this from Andrew Miller.
Yes, South Africa has been talking for years about seizing land without compensation, and now finally here, just the past few days and weeks, they've started to actually go ahead with this, with the government seizing two game ranches in western South Africa for not without compensation, but forcibly taking them for a tenth of what their owners were asking for. And then this is... gained international news publicity enough to where President Donald Trump actually tweeted out this week that he was instructing his Secretary of State to look into the farm murder epidemic in South Africa, with all the rhetoric about taking land from farmers has led to a huge increase in like people taking matters into their own hands and killing and in many cases brutally torturing farmers across South Africa. And so President Trump has instructed his Secretary of State to just look into the large-scale killing of farmers, which has provoked a fairly shocking international backlash and a backlash in both South Africa and the United States. In South Africa, it seems that it would be a little more expected. They are the ones that are taking this land from farmers without compensation, and this is the place where the murder's happening. And so I saw where one South African politician had likened Donald Trump to a KKK leader for even tweeting that we should look into farm murder epidemics. Julius Malema, he's the leader of a Marxist party in South Africa who's known for his inflammatory rhetoric, had said that after Trump's tweet, he said, "We remain unshaken. Actually, we are more determined to expropriate our land without compensation. There is no white genocide here. Those statements are absolute rubbish. There's actually a black genocide in the United States. They are killing black people in the U.S. Black people are even being killed here in South Africa." So he's coming back against Donald Trump, accusing him of
genocide,
a black genocide in the United States. And which is interesting because Donald Trump actually never even said there was a white genocide in South Africa. He actually never even mentioned the word white. He just said, "I want my Secretary of State to look into farm killings in South Africa." And I mean, there have been black farmers killed too. If they have money, Julius Malema's organization is a communist organization. And a lot of the people who are taking farms are taking them. I mean, they're killing black farmers and they're killing white farmers. They're killing a lot more white farmers. And it would be naive to say there's no racial animosity in these killings, but there is a racial component, and then there is just an outright Marxist component where you're taking land from the rich. Mm.
So, but the out of everyone looking at this situation, Donald Trump expressing concern about this, it seems that there are some Western commentators who are taking the side of Julius Malema in this argument.
Right. I mean, there have been many articles in, well, pretty much all the big media outlets, New York Times, Vox, that have accused Donald Trump of peddling a racist conspiracy theory, which, again, he never mentioned race in the tweet. He just said he wants his Secretary of State to look into.
It does say, he quotes Tucker Carlson, "South African government is now seizing land from white farmers." But, I mean, that's just stating
right.
the facts.
Well, he quoted the Tucker Carlson show, which, and I think Tucker Carlson said that. Trump, yeah. He just said large-scale killing of farmers. But yeah, it was even, I've got this quote where it was President Obama's ambassador to South Africa, who's no longer in office, but Patrick Gaspard, who he came out and said, he's like, "Here you have the president of the United States who is trafficking in a white supremacist storyline and a talking point that has caused incredible damage in the country, in the region, and that is easily disproved." So this is the former ambassador to South Africa, the ambassador under President Obama, accusing the president of peddling a racist conspiracy theory that he claims isn't happening. And I mean, there's the statistics are
terrible.
Concrete.
Yeah.
That there have been 1,848 people murdered in farm attacks between 1988 and today. And that's a conservative statistic. So when you crunch the numbers, it's like a farmer in South Africa is four times likelier to be murdered than a policeman. Mm. It is by far and enlarged the most dangerous profession, more dangerous than policeman, more dangerous than judge, more dangerous than politician, more dangerous than even the South African military. Farming is your most dangerous profession there. And since most South African farmers are white, they're definitely being the white farmers are being killed at a much higher rate than mm-hmm. any other demographic.
So
in South Africa,
it shows the state of race in South Africa, and we also get a picture of the state of race in the United States with this story.
Right, and if President Trump sticks to his guns here and really does start to speak out more against this these farm killings in South Africa, it will undoubtedly have an impact, at least on the rhetoric, maybe even on riots and stuff like that here in the United States. I mean, you've got the extremist wing of the Black Lives Matter movement that are totally on board with Julius Malema's comment that Trump is waging a black genocide here in the United States. And you start to see this, like, this ideological alignment between the two movements in South Africa and the U.S. Mm.
Amazing story. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and literature we discussed on the program. Email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Robert Louis Stevenson. Keep your fears to yourself, but share your courage with others. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.